It's a pot of posies. Suzanne Wiegma-Sock will not be the first person to compost a human body. That honor goes to an American named Tim Evans. I heard about Evans while visiting the University of Tennessee's Human Decay Research Facility, see Chapter 3. As a graduate student, Evans had investigated human composting as an option for third world countries where the majority of the people can't afford coffins or cremation. In Haiti and parts of rural China, Evans told me, unclaimed bodies and bodies from poor families are often dumped in open pits. In China, the corpses are then burned using high sulfur coal. In 1998, Evans procured the body of a ne'er-do-well whose family had donated him to the university. He never knew he was going to end up as compost guy, recalled Evans when I telephoned him. This was probably just as well. To supply the requisite bacteria to break down the tissue, Evans composted the body with manure and soiled wood shavings from stables. The dignity issue reared its delicate head. Wiegma-Sock would not be using manure. She plans to mix a little dose of freeze-dried bacteria in with each box of remains. And because the man was buried whole, Evans had to go out with a shovel and rake to aerate him 3 or 4 times. This is why Wiegma-Sock plans to break bodies up with either vibration or ultrasound. The tiny pieces are easily saturated with oxygen and so quickly composted and assimilated that they can be used immediately for planting. It was also in part a matter of dignity and aesthetics. The body has to be unrecognizable while it composts, says Wiegma-Sock. It has to be in small pieces. Can you imagine the family sitting around the dinner table and someone says, "Okay, Sven, it's your turn to go out and turn mother." Indeed, Evans had something of a rough go of it, though in his case it was more the setting than the deed. It was hard being out there, he told me. I used to think, what am I doing here? I'd just put on my blinders and go to the pile. It took a month and a half for Compost Guy to complete his return to the soil. Evans was pleased with the result, which he described as really dark, rich stuff with good moisture-holding capacity. He offered to send me a sample, which might or might not have been illegal. You need a permit to ship an unembalmed cadaver across state lines, but there is nothing on the books regarding the shipping of a composted cadaver. We decided to leave it be. Evans was pleased to note that a healthy crop of weeds had begun growing out of the top of the compost bin toward the end of the process. He had been concerned about certain fatty acids in the body, which might, if not thoroughly broken down, prove toxic to plant roots. In the end, the government of Haiti respectfully declined Evans's proposal. The Chinese government, in what was either a remarkable show of environmental concern or desire to save money, manure being cheaper than coal, did express interest in human composting as an alternative to open-pit coal burnings. Evans and his advisor, Arpad Vass, prepared a white paper on the practical advantages of human composting. Quote, material can then be safely used in land applications as a soil amendment or fertilizer, end quote, but received no further word. Evans has plans to work with veterinarians in Southern California to make composting available to pet owners. Like Wiegma-Sock, he envisions families planting a tree or shrub, which would take up the deceased molecules and become a living memorial. This is as close, he said to me, as science is going to get to reincarnation. I asked Evans if he plans to try to crack the mortuary market. There are two questions there, he answered. If I was asking whether he wanted to make composting available to people, the answer was yes, but he didn't feel sure he wanted to make the process available through funeral homes. One of the things that got me interested in this is a disdain for current practices of the funeral industry, he said. You shouldn't have to pay exorbitant amounts of money to die. Ultimately, he'd like to offer it through a company of his own. I then asked how he imagined he'd get the word out, get the ball rolling. He said he had tried to get a celebrity interested in the cause. The hope was that someone like Paul Newman or Warren Beatty might do for composting what Timothy Leary did for space burials. As Evans was living in Lawrence, Kansas at the time, he called fellow Kansan William S. Burroughs, who struck him as suitably eccentric and moribund, to consider it. The calls were not returned. He eventually did try to contact Paul Newman. His daughter runs a horse stable doing rehabilitation for handicapped kids. I thought he could use the manure, Evans said. They were probably thinking, what a freak. Evans isn't a freak. He's just a free thinker on a topic most people would rather not think about. Evans' advisor, Arpad Vass, summed it up best. Composting is a wonderful possibility. I just don't think the mentality of this country is there yet. The mentality of Sweden is a good deal closer. The thought of living on as a willow tree or rhododendron bush might easily appeal to a nation of gardeners and recyclers. I don't know what percentage of Swedes have gardens, but plants seem very important to them. Business lobbies in Sweden hold tiny forests of potted trees. In a roadside restaurant in Jönköping, I saw a ficus plant inside a revolving door. The Swedes are a practical people, a people who appreciate simplicity and abhor frou-frou. The stationery of the Swedish king is simply embossed with his seal. At a distance, it appears to be a plain sheet of cream-colored paper. Hotel rooms are furnished with what a reasonable traveler might need and nothing more. There's one pad of paper, not three, and the end of the toilet paper is not triangulated. To be freeze-dried and reduced to a hygienic bag of compost and incorporated into a plant, I suppose, might appeal to the Swedish ethos. That is not the only thing that has made Sweden the right place at the right time for the human compost movement. As it happens, the crematoria in Sweden have been hit with environmental regulations regarding volatilized mercury from fillings, and many need to make costly upgrades to their equipment within the next 2 years. Purchasing Wigmasak's machinery would, she says, cost many of them less than would complying with government regulations, and burial hasn't been popular here for decades. Wigmasak explained that part of the Swedes' distaste for interment can be traced to the fact that in Sweden you must share your grave. After 25 years, a grave is reopened, and the men in gas masks, as Wigmasak puts it, haul you up, dig the grave deeper, and bury someone else on top of you. This is not to say that Promessa faces no resistance. Wigmasak must convince the people whose jobs will be affected should composting become a reality, the funeral directors, the coffin makers, the embalmers, people whose apple carts stand to be upset. Yesterday she gave a talk at a conference of parish administrators in Jönköping. These are the people who would care for the person plants in the churchyard memorial park. While she spoke, I scanned the audience for smirks and rolling eyes, but saw none. Most of the comments seemed positive, though it was hard to tell, as the comments were in Swedish and my interpreter had never actually interpreted before. He consulted frequently with a piece of graph paper on which he had written out a list of mortuary and composting vocabulary in Swedish and English. Formultning, moldering, decay. At one point, a balding man in a dark gray suit raised his hand to say that he thought composting took away the specialness of being human. In this process, we are equal to some animal that dies in the woods, he said. Wigmasak explained that she was only concerned with the body, that the soul or spirit would be addressed, as it has always been, in a memorial service or ritual of the family's choosing. He didn't seem to hear this. Do you look around this room, he said, and see nothing more than 100 bags of fertilizer? My interpreter whispered that the man was a funeral director. Apparently, 3 or 4 of them had crashed the conference. When Wigmasak finished and the crowd moved to the back of the hall for coffee and pastries, I joined the man in the gray suit and his fellow undertakers. Across from me sat a man with white hair named Kurt. He wore a suit, too, but his was checkered, and he had an air of jollity that made it hard for me to picture him running a funeral home. He said he thought that the ecological funeral would one day, perhaps in 10 years, become a reality. It used to be that the priest told the people how to do it, he said, referring to memorial rites and rituals and the disposition of the body. Today, the people tell the priest. According to Prothero, this was also the case with cremation. Part of the appeal of scattering ashes was that it took the last rites out of the hands of the undertakers and handed them over to the family and friends, freeing them to do something more personally meaningful than what the undertaker might have had in mind. Kurt added that young people in Sweden had recently begun moving away from cremation because of the pollution it creates. Now the young can go to grandma and say, "I have a new way for you, a cold bath." Then he laughed and clapped his hands. I decided that this was the sort of man I wanted running my funeral. Wigma Sock joined us. You are a very good salesman, the man in the gray suit told her. He works for Fonus, Scandinavia's largest mortuary corporation. The man let Wigma Sock take in the compliment before stepping on it. But you haven't convinced me. Wigma Sock didn't flinch. I expected to get some resistance, she told him. That's why I'm so surprised and pleased to see that almost everyone in the audience looks happy while I talk. Believe me, they're not, said the man pleasantly. If I didn't have an interpreter, I'd think they were discussing the pastries. I hear what they say. On the drive back to Lerun, the man in the gray suit became known as the Slime. I hope we don't see him tomorrow, Wigma Sock said to me. At 3 o'clock the following afternoon in Stockholm, she was scheduled to give a presentation before the top regional managers of Fonus. That she was speaking there was a matter of some pride. 2 years ago, they hadn't returned her phone calls. This time, it was they who called her. Suzanne Wigma Sock does not own a business suit. She delivers her presentations in what American dress code arbiters would term smart casual, trousers and a sweater, with her waist-length, wheat-colored hair braided and pinned up in back. She wears no makeup for these talks, though her face tends to flush mildly, bestowing a youthful blush. In the past, the organic look has worked in Wigma Sock's favor. When she met with Church of Sweden clergy back in 1999, they were comforted by Wigma Sock's non-commercial mien. They said to me, "You are really not a seller," she tells me as she dresses for the trip to Fonus's Stockholm headquarters. She really isn't. While as 51% owner of Promessa's shares, Wigma Sock stands to earn a substantial sum should the process take off. Wealth is clearly not her motive. Wigma Sock has been a hardcore ecologist since the age of 17. This is a woman who takes trains instead of driving to make herself less of a burden on the environment and who disapproves of holidaymakers flying to Thailand when a beach in Spain would suffice on the grounds that jet fuel is needlessly burned. She readily admits that Promessa has little to do with death and everything to do with the environment, that it is essentially a vehicle for spreading the gospel of ecology. The dead bodies attract the media and public attention in a way that the environmental message alone could not. She is a rarity among social advocates, the environmentalist who is not preaching to the converted. Today is a good example. 10 mortuary company executives are about to sit through an hour-long talk about the importance of giving back to the earth through organic composting. How often does that happen? The Fonus headquarters takes up the better part of the third floor of a nondescript Stockholm office building. The interior designers have gone out of their way to infuse color and nature into the surroundings. An arrangement of cafe tables is surrounded by a sort of indoor hedge of potted trees, in the midst of which stands an immaculate tropical fish tank the size of a plate glass window. Death is nowhere in evidence. A bowl of complimentary lint brushes bearing the Fonus logo calls out to me from the receptionist's desk. Wigma Sock and I are introduced to Ulf Helsing, a vice director of the corporation. The name hits my ears as Elf Helsing, causing great internal merriment. Helsing is dressed like all the other elves in the lobby, in the same gray suit with the same royal blue dress shirt and the same subdued tie and silver Fonus lapel pin. I ask Helsing why Fonus instigated the meeting. As Wigma Sock envisions it, it is Sweden's crematoria, until recently operated by the church, that would be doing the freeze-drying. The funeral homes would simply make the option known to their clients, or not, depending on what they decide. "We've been following this in the paper, but we kept a low profile," came his enigmatic reply. "It is time we heard more." Possibly contributing to the decision was the fact that 62% of 300 visitors to the Fonus website answered in a survey that they would be interested in an ecological funeral. "You know," Helsing adds as he stirs his coffee, "that freeze-drying corpses is not a new idea. Someone in your country came up with this about 10 years ago." He is talking about a retired science teacher from Eugene, Oregon, named Philip Backman. Wigma Sock told me about him. Backman, like Tim Evans and the cremationists of yore, was inspired by a loathing of funerary pomp. He spent several years at Arlington National Cemetery arranging military funerals that much of the time no one showed up for. This, combined with a background in chemistry, got him interested in the possibilities of freeze-drying as another alternative to burial. He knew that liquid nitrogen, a waste product of certain industrial processes, is cheaper than natural gas. Wigmasak estimates the liquid nitrogen cost per body at $30. The gas for a cremation costs about $100. To break down the frozen bodies for freeze-drying, a whole human body would take over a year into tiny, quickly freeze-dryable pieces. He proposed running them through a machine. "It's something on the order of what they do with chipped beef," he told me when we spoke. It was a hammer mill, Wigmasak later told me. Backman managed to secure a patent for the process, but the concept was coolly received at local mortuaries. No one wanted to talk about it, so I just let it go. The meeting begins on time. 10 regional directors for the company, along with their laptops and their polite gazes, gather in the conference room. Wigmasak begins by talking about the difference between organic and inorganic remains, how cremains contain little nutritive value. When we are burning remains, we don't give it back to the earth. We are built up from nature, and we have to give it back. The audience seems respectfully quiet and attentive, except for my interpreter and me, whispering in the back row like poorly brought-up schoolgirls. I notice Helsing writing. At first he appears to be taking notes, but then he folds the sheet in two, and when Wigmasak's back is turned, slides it across the table, where it is passed along to its recipient, who slips it under his notebook until Wigmasak turns away again. They let Wigmasak talk for 20 minutes before they begin asking questions. Helsing leads the pack. "I have an ethical question," he says. "An elk dying in the woods and returning to the earth is just lying on the ground. Here you are doing something to break it up." Wigmasak replies that in fact an elk that dies in the woods is likely to be torn up and eaten by scavengers. And while it is true that the dung of whoever eats the elk would act as a sort of elk compost and, in effect, achieve the desired goal, it was not something she could envision families being comfortable with. Helsing pinkened slightly. This was not where he intended things to go, conversationally. He persists, "But can you see the ethical problem of breaking it up this way?" Wigmasak has heard this line of argument before. A technician at a Danish ultrasound company, whom she contacted early on in the project, declined to work with her for this reason. He felt that representing ultrasound as a nonviolent way of breaking up tissue was dishonest. Wigmasak was undeterred. "Listen," she said to the morticians, "we all know that taking a body down to powder requires some sort of energy, but ultrasound at least has a positive image. You cannot see the violence." "I would like it to be possible for the family to watch it happening behind a glass wall. I want something where I can show a child, and the child won't start crying." Glances are exchanged. A man clicks his pen. Wigmasak makes a small detour into defensive mode. "I think that if you put a camera inside a coffin, we wouldn't be very impressed with ourselves, as a terrible result." Someone asks why the freeze-drying step is needed. Wigmasak answers that if you don't remove the water, the little pieces will start to decompose and smell before you can get them into the ground. "But you mustn't get rid of the water," the man counters, "because this is 70% of this person." Wigmasak tries to explain that the water inside each one of us changes day by day. It's borrowed. It comes in, it goes out. The molecules from your water mix with someone else's. She points to the man's coffee cup. "The coffee you are drinking has been your neighbor's urine." You have to admire a woman who can toss the word urine into a corporate presentation. The man who has been clicking his pen is the first to raise the subject that is surely on everyone's mind, coffins and the disappearing profit therefrom that an ecological funeral movement will mean. Wigmasak envisions the freeze-dried, powdered remains being placed in a miniature, biodegradable cornstarch coffin. "That's a problem," acknowledges Wigmasak. "Everyone will be angry with me." She smiles. "I guess there will have to be a new thinking." As with cremation, a standard coffin could be rented for a memorial service. Cremationists faced the same objections. For years, according to Stephen Prothero, undertakers were advised to tell their clients that scattering was against the law, when in fact, with few exceptions, it wasn't. Families were pushed to buy memorial urns and niches in columbaria, and even standard cemetery plots in which to bury the urns. But the families persisted in their push for a simple, meaningful ceremony of their own making, and scattering caught on. As did the use of rental caskets for pre-cremation services and the manufacturing of inexpensive cardboard cremation containers for the actual burning. The only reason there are rental caskets, Kevin McCabe once told me, is that the public demanded it. The tremendous attention that Promesa has received since its founding has forced the funeral industry to deal with the possibility that very soon people may be coming to them requesting to be composted. In a Swedish newspaper poll taken last year, 40% of respondents said they'd like to be freeze-dried and used to grow a plant. Mortuaries in Sweden may not be actively recommending the ecological funeral anytime soon, but they may stop short of trying to derail it. As a friendly young Fonus regional director named Peter Goransson said to me earlier, it's pretty hard to stop something once it's rolling. The last question comes from a man seated next to Ulf Helsing. He asks Wigmasak whether she plans to first market the technique for dead animals. She is adamant about not letting this happen. If Promesa becomes known as a company that disposes of dead cows or pets, she tells the man, it will lose the dignity necessary for a human application. It is difficult, as it is, to attach the requisite dignity to human composting. At least in the United States, not long ago I called the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the official U.S. mouthpiece of the Catholic Church, to ask its opinion on freeze-drying and composting as an alternative to burial. I was put through to a Monsignor John Strinkowski in the doctrine office. While the Monsignor allowed that composting and nourishing the earth was little different from a Trappist monk's plain shroud burial or a church-sanctioned burial at sea, following which the body will, as he put it, provide nourishment for fish, the idea of composting struck him as disrespectful. I asked him why. Well, when I was a kid, he answered, we had a hole where we put peelings from apples and such and used it for fertilizer. That's just my association. While I had him on the phone, I asked Monsignor Strinkowski about tissue digestion. He replied with minimal hesitation that the church would be opposed to the idea of human remains going into the drain. He explained that the Catholic Church feels that the human body should always be given a dignified burial, whether it's the body itself or the ashes. Scattering remains a sin. When I explained that the company planned to add an optional dehydrator to the system that could reduce the liquefied remains to a powder that could then be buried just as cremains can be, the line went quiet. Finally, he said, I guess that would be okay. You got the feeling Monsignor Strinkowski was looking forward to the end of the phone call. The line between solid waste disposal and funerary rituals must be well maintained. Interestingly, this is one of the reasons the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't regulate U.S. crematoria. For if it did regulate them, the rules would be promulgated under Section 129 of the Clean Air Act, which covers solid waste incinerators. And that would mean, explained Fred Porter of the EPA Emission Standards Division in Washington, that what we're incinerating at crematoria is solid waste. The EPA does not wish to stand accused of calling America's dead loved ones solid waste. Wigmasak may succeed in taking composting mainstream because she realizes the importance of keeping respectful disposition distinct from waste disposal, of addressing the family's need for a dignified end. To a certain extent, of course, dignity is in the packaging. When you get right down to it, there is no dignified way to go, be it decomposition, incineration, dissection, tissue digestion, or composting. They're all, bottom line, a little disagreeable. It takes the careful application of a well-considered euphemism, burial, cremation, anatomical gift-giving, water reduction, ecological funeral, to bring it to the point of acceptance. I used to think the traditional Navy burial at sea sounded nice. I pictured the sun on the ocean, the infinite expanse of blue, the nowhereness of it. Then, one day, I had a conversation with Philip Backman, during which he mentioned that one of the cleanest, quickest, and most ecologically pure things to do with a body would be to put it in a big tide pool full of Dungeness crabs, which apparently enjoy eating people as much as people enjoy eating crabs. "It'll do the thing in a couple of days," he said. "It's all recycled, and it's all clean and taken care of." My affinity for burial at sea, not to mention crab meat, was suddenly dramatically diminished. Wigmasock finishes speaking, and the group applauds. If they think of her as the enemy, they do a good job of concealing it. On the way out, a photographer asks us to pose with Helsing and a couple of the other executives for the company webpage. We stand with one foot and shoulder forward, arranged in facing columns like doo-wop backup singers in unusually drab costumes. While I avail myself of a Phonus lint brush, I hear Helsing say that the company plans to add a link to Promessa on its website. A wary friendship has been forged. On the road between Jönköping and Wigmasock's home on Laroon is a graveyard on a hill. If you drive all the way through to the back of this graveyard, you come to a small field where the church will one day dig more graves. Halfway up the unmown terrain, a small rhododendron bush stands among the weeds. This is the Promessa test grave. Last December, Wigmasock concocted the approximate equivalent of a 150-pound human cadaver using freeze-dried cow blood and freeze-dried pulverized bones and meat. She placed the powder in a cornstarch box and the box in a shallow, 35 centimeters down so the compost could still get oxygen, grave. In June, she will return to dig it up and make sure the container has disintegrated and the contents have begun their metaphysical journey. Wigmasock and I stand in silence beside the grave of the unknown livestock as though paying our respects. It's dark now and hard to see the plant, though it appears to be doing well. I tell Wigmasock that I think it's great, this quest for an ecologically sound, meaningful memorial. I tell her I'm rooting for her, then quickly rephrase the sentiment, omitting gardening-related verbs. And I am. I hope Wigmasock succeeds, and I hope WR2 succeeds. I'm all for choices, in death as in life. Wigmasock is encouraged by my support, as she has been by the support of the Church of Sweden and her corporate backers, and the people who have responded positively in the polls. "It was and is," she confides as the wind shimmies the leaves on the cow's memorial shrub. "Very important to feel I'm not crazy." Chapter 12. Remains of the Author. Will she or won't she? It has long been a tradition among anatomy professors to donate their bodies to medical science. Hugh Patterson, the UCSF professor whose lab I visited, looks at it this way. "I've enjoyed teaching anatomy, and look, I get to do it after I die." He told me he felt like he was cheating death. According to Patterson, the venerable anatomy teachers of Renaissance Padua and Bologna, as death sidled near, would choose their best student and ask him to prepare their skull as an anatomical exhibit. Should you one day visit Padua, you can see some of these skulls at the University Medical School. I don't teach anatomy, but I understand the impulse. Some months back, I gave thought to becoming a skeleton in a medical school classroom. Years ago, I read a Ray Bradbury story about a man who becomes obsessed with his skeleton. He has come to think of it as a sentient, sinister entity that lives inside him, biding its time until he dies and the bones slowly prevail. I began thinking about my skeleton, this solid, beautiful thing inside me that I would never see. I didn't see it becoming my usurper, but more my stand-in, my means to earthly immortality. I've enjoyed hanging around in rooms doing nothing much, and look, I get to do it after I die. Plus, on the off chance that an afterlife exists and that it includes the option of home planet visitations, I'd be able to pop by the med school and finally see what my bones looked like. I like the idea that when I was gone, my skeleton would live on in some sunny, boisterous anatomy classroom. I wanted to be a mystery in some future medical student's head. Who was this woman? What did she do? How did she come to be here? Of course, the mystery could as easily be engendered by a more routine donation of my remains. Upward of 80% of the bodies left to science are used for anatomy lab dissections. Most assuredly, a lab cadaver occupies the thoughts and dreams of its dissectors. The problem for me is that, while a skeleton is ageless and aesthetically pleasing, an 80-year-old corpse is withered and dead. The thought of young people gazing in horror and repulsion at my sagging flesh and atrophied limbs does not hold strong appeal. I'm 43, and already they're doing it. A skeleton seemed the less humiliating course. I actually went so far as to contact a facility at the University of New Mexico's Maxwell Museum of Anthropology that accepts bodies specifically to harvest the bones. I told the woman who runs it about my book and said that I wanted to come see how skeletons are made. In the Bradbury story, the protagonist ends up having his bones pulled out through his mouth by an alien disguised as a beautiful woman. Though he was reduced to a jellyfish heap on his living room floor, his body remained intact. No blood was spilled. This was, of course, not the case at the Maxwell Lab. I was told I would have the choice of observing one of two steps, a cut-down or a pour-off. The cut-down was more or less what it sounded like. They got the bones out the only way, barring retractable and highly specialized alien mouthparts, one can, by cutting away the flesh and muscle that surrounds them. Residual meat and sinew is dissolved by boiling the bones in a solution for a few weeks, periodically pouring off the broth and replacing the solution. I pictured the young men of Padua tending to their beloved professor's heads as they simmered and bobbed. I pictured the actors in a Shakespearean theater troupe I read about last year, confronted by a dead cast member's last request that his skull be used as Yorick. People really need to think these requests through. About a month later, I got another email from the university. They were writing to tell me they had switched to an insect-based process, wherein fly larvae and carnivorous beetles perform their own scaled-down, drawn-out version of the cut-down. I did not sign on to become a skeleton. For one thing, I don't live in New Mexico, and they won't come pick you up. Also, it turns out that the university doesn't make skeletons, only bones. The bones are left unarticulated and added to the university's osteological collection. No one in this country, I learned, is making skeletons for medical schools. The vast majority of the world's medical school skeletons have, over the years, been imported from Calcutta. No longer. According to a June 15, 1986, Chicago Tribune story, India banned the export of bones in 1985 after reports surfaced of children being kidnapped and murdered for their bones and skulls. According to one story, which I desperately hope is exaggerated, 1,500 children per month were being killed in the state of Bihar, their bones then sent to Calcutta for processing and export. Since the ban, the supply of human bones has dwindled to almost nothing. Some come out of Asia, where it is rumored they are dug up from Chinese cemeteries and stolen from Cambodia's killing fields. They are old, mossy, and generally of poor quality, and for the most part, detailed plastic skeletons have taken their place. So much for my future as a skeleton. For similarly dumb and narcissistic reasons, I also once considered spending eternity at the Harvard Brain Bank. I wrote about it in my Salon.com column, which was disappointing for the Brain Bank's director, who assumed I would be writing a serious article about the facility's serious and very worthwhile research pursuits. Here is an abridged version of the column. There are many good reasons to become a brain donor. One of the best is to advance the study of mental dysfunction. Researchers cannot study animal brains to learn about mental illness because animals don't get mentally ill. While some animals, cats for example, and dogs, small enough to fit into bicycle baskets, seem to incorporate mental illness as a natural personality feature, animals are not known to have diagnosable brain disorders like Alzheimer's and schizophrenia. So researchers need to study brains of mentally ill humans and, as controls, brains of normal humans like you and me. Okay, you. My reasons for becoming a donor aren't very good at all. My reasons boil down to a Harvard Brain Bank donor wallet card, which enables me to say, I'm going to Harvard, and not be lying. You do not need brains to go to the Harvard Brain Bank. Only a brain. One fine fall day, I decided to visit my final resting place. The Brain Bank is part of Harvard's McLean Hospital, which sits on a rolling estate of handsome brick buildings just outside Boston. I was directed to the third floor of the Mailman Research Building. The woman pronounced it Melman so as to avoid having to answer stupid questions about what kind of research is being done on mailmen. If you are considering becoming a brain donor, the best thing for you to do is stay away from the brain bank. Within 10 minutes of arriving, I was watching a 24-year-old technician slice a 67-year-old brain. The brain had been flash frozen and did not slice cleanly. It sliced as does a butterfinger, with little shards crumbling off. The shards quickly thawed and looked less butterfinger-like. The technician wiped them up with a paper towel. There goes third grade. He's gotten in trouble for saying things like this. I read a newspaper story in which the reporter asked him if he planned to donate his brain, and he replied, "No way. I'm going out with whatever I came in with." Now when you ask him, he says quietly, "I'm only 24, I really don't know." A brain bank spokesman showed me around. Down the hall from the dissection room was the computer room. The spokesman referred to this as the brains of the operation, which in any other operation would have been fine, but in this case was a tad confusing. At the end of the hall were the real brains. It wasn't quite what I imagined. I had pictured whole intact brains floating in glass jars, but the brains were cut in half, one side being sliced and frozen, the other side sliced and stored in formaldehyde inside Rubbermaid and Freezette food savers. Somehow I'd expected more of Harvard. If not glass, at least Tupperware. I wondered what the dorms look like these days. The spokesman assured me that no one would even be able to tell that my brain was missing. He assured me in a way that assured me, and at the same time didn't bring me a lot closer to being a committed brain donor. "First," he began, "they cut the skin like this and pull it up over the face." Here he made a motion as though taking off a Halloween mask. "They use a saw to cut the top of the skull off, the brain is removed, and the skull is put back and screwed in place. Put the skin flap back and comb the hair back over." He used the peppy how-to language of an infomercial host, making brain harvesting sound like something that takes just minutes and wipes clean with a damp cloth. Yet again, I backed off from my plan. Not so much because of the harvesting process. As you may have gleaned, I'm not a squeamish individual, but because of my mistaken expectations. I wanted to be a brain in a jar at Harvard. I wanted to look atmospheric and fascinating on a shelf. I didn't want to spend the hereafter as cut-up pieces in a storeroom refrigerator. There is but one way to be an organ on a shelf, and that is to be plastinated. Plastination is the process of taking organic tissue, a rosebud, say, or a human head, and replacing the water in it with a liquid silicone polymer, turning the organism into a permanently preserved version of itself. Plastination was developed by German anatomist Gunther von Hagens. Like most plastinators, von Hagens makes educational models for anatomy programs. He is best known, however, for his controversial plastinated whole-body art exhibit, Körperwelten, or in England, Body Worlds, which has toured Europe for the past 5 years, raising eyebrows and tidy sums of cash. Attendance to date is over 8 million. The skinless bodies are posed as living people in action, swimming, riding, plastinated horse included, playing chess. One figure's skin flies out behind it like a cape. Von Hagens cites as inspiration the works of Renaissance anatomists such as Andreas Vesalius, whose De Humani Corporis Fabrica featured bodies drawn in active human poses, rather than lying flat or standing arms to the side, a la the typical medical illustration. A skeleton waves hello. A muscle man gazes at the view from a hilltop of the town below. Körperwelten raises the ire of church fathers and conservatives wherever it opens, mainly on the grounds of violated dignity. Von Hagens counters that the bodies in the show were donated by their owners specifically for this purpose. He leaves a stack of donor forms at the exit of the exhibit. According to a 2001 London Observer article, the donor list is up to 3,700. Most of von Hagen's bodies are plastinated in China in an operation called Plastination City. He is said to employ 200 Chinese in what sounds to me like a sort of cadaver sweatshop. This is not all that surprising, as his technique is extremely labor-intensive and time-consuming. It takes over a year to plastinate one individual. The U.S. version of the technique, modified by Dow Corning after von Hagen's patent expired, takes 1/10 the time. I contacted von Hagen's office in Germany to see if I could visit Plastination City and see what kind of shenanigans are in store for a donor body, but von Hagen's was on the road and did not return my emails in time. Instead of China, I traveled to the University of Michigan Medical School, where anatomy professor Roy Glover and plastination chemicals manufacturer Dan Kokorin, who worked with Dow Corning to update the technique, have been plastinating whole dead bodies for a museum project of their own called Exhibit Human, The Wonders Within, slated to open in San Francisco in mid-2003. Theirs is strictly educational. 12 plastinated, well, Kokorin prefers the term polymer preserved, bodies, each displaying a different system, nervous, digestive, reproductive, etc. At press date, no U.S. museum has signed up to exhibit Corpervelten. Glover offered to show me how plastination works. We met in his office. Glover has a long face that made me think of Leo G. Carroll. I had recently seen Tarantula, wherein Carroll plays a scientist who figures out how to make huge, scary versions of harmless animals, e.g. guinea pigs the size of police dogs. You could tell Glover was a nice guy because a to-do list on a whiteboard on his office wall said, Maria Lopez, Brain for Daughter, Science Fair. I decided that this was what I wanted to do with my remains. Travel around to classrooms and science fairs, astounding children and inspiring careers in science. Glover took me across the hall to a storeroom with a wall of shelves crowded with plastinated human pieces and parts. There was a brain sliced like a loaf of bread and a head split in two so that you could see the labyrinths of the sinuses and the deep, secret source of the tongue. You could pick the organs up and marvel at them, for they were completely dry and had no smell, yet still, they were clearly real and not plastic. For the many disciplines, dentistry, nursing, speech pathology, that study anatomy but have no time for dissection, models like these are a godsend. Glover took me down the hall to the plastination lab, which was chilly and cluttered with heavy, strange-looking tanks. He began explaining the process. First, the body is washed. This is done much as it was when the body was alive, in a tub. This is a body, said Glover, quite unnecessarily, regarding a figure on its back in the tub. The man had been in his 60s. He had a mustache and a tattoo, both of which would survive the plastination process. The head was submerged, giving the corpse a disconcerting murder victim sort of look. Also, the front chest wall had been separated from the rest of the torso and lay off to the side of the body. It looked like a Roman gladiator's chest plate, or maybe I just found it helpful to think of it that way. Glover said that he and Kokorin planned to reattach it with a hinge on one side so that it would swing open, like a refrigerator door, to reveal the organs within. Months later, I saw photos of the exhibit pieces. Disappointingly, someone must have nixed the refrigerator door idea. The second body lay in a stainless steel tank of acetone, which filled the lab with a powerful smell of nail polish remover each time Dr. Glover lifted the lid. The acetone drives water from the body's tissue, readying it for impregnation with the silicone polymer. I tried to picture this dead man propped on a stand in a science museum. Will he be wearing anything, or will his penis just be hanging out? I asked tactlessly. He's going to have it hanging out, replied Glover. I got the feeling he'd been asked this question before. I mean, this is a perfectly normal part of a person's anatomy. Why should we attempt to hide what's normal? From the acetone bath, the cadavers are transferred to the whole-body plastination chamber, a cylindrical stainless steel tank filled with liquid polymer. A vacuum attached to the tank lowers the internal pressure, turning the acetone to a gas and drawing it from the body. When the acetone comes out of the specimen, it creates space, and into that space is pulled the polymer, said Glover. He handed me a flashlight so I could see the view through a porthole on the top of the chamber, which happened to look down onto a perfectly normal part of a person's anatomy. It looked peaceful in there. Like a guinea pig the size of a police dog, the concept of being plastinated is more unsettling than the reality. You just lie there, soaking and plastinating. Eventually, someone lifts you out and poses you, much as one poses a Gumby. A catalyst is then rubbed into your skin, and a 2-day hardening process begins, working its way through your tissues, preserving you for all eternity in your freshly dead state. I asked Dean Mueller, a southeastern Michigan funeral director, whose company, Eternal Preservation, offers mortuary plastination for about $50,000, how long he thought a plastinated specimen would last. He said at least 10,000 years, which is about as eternal as anyone in their right or even their wrong mind could care about. Mueller has high hopes that the process will catch on among heads of state. Think what plastination could have done for Lenin. And rich eccentrics, and I imagine that it might. I would happily donate my organs as teaching tools, but unless I move to Michigan or some other state with a plastination lab, I can't. I could ask my loved ones to ship me to Michigan, but that would be silly. Besides, you can't specify what happens to you when you donate your remains to science, only what doesn't happen. The dead people whose parts Glover and Kilcoyne have plastinated over the years checked a box on their University of Michigan donor form indicating they did not object to permanent preservation, but they didn't request it specifically. Here's the other thing I think about. It makes little sense to try to control what happens to your remains when you're no longer around to reap the joys or benefits of that control. People who make elaborate requests concerning disposition of their bodies are probably people who have trouble with the concept of not existing. Leaving a note requesting that your family and friends travel to the Ganges or ship your body to a plastination lab in Michigan is a way of exerting influence after you're gone, of still being there in a sense. I imagine it is a symptom of the fear, the dread of being gone, of the refusal to accept that you no longer control or even participate in anything that happens on Earth. I spoke about this with funeral director Kevin McCabe, who believes that decisions concerning the disposition of a body should be made by the survivors, not the dead. "It's none of their business what happens to them when they die," he said to me. Well, I wouldn't go that far. I do understand what he was getting at, that the survivors shouldn't have to do something they're uncomfortable with or ethically opposed to. Mourning and moving on are hard enough. Why add to the burden? If someone wants to arrange a balloon launch of the deceased's ashes into inner space, that's fine. But if it is burdensome or troubling for any reason, then perhaps they shouldn't have to. McCabe's policy is to honor the wishes of the family over the wishes of the dead. Willed body program coordinators feel similarly. "I've had kids object to their dad's wishes to donate," says Ron Wade, director of the Anatomical Services Division of the University of Maryland School of Medicine. "I tell them, do what's best for you. You're the one who has to live with it." I saw this happen between my father and mother. My father, who rejected organized religion early in his life, asked my mother to have him cremated in a plain pine box and to hold no memorial service. My mother, against her Catholic inclinations, honored his wishes. She later regretted it. People she barely knew confronted her about their disappointment over there having been no memorial service. My father had been a beloved character around town. My mother felt shamed and slandered. The urn was a further source of discomfort, partly because the Catholic Church insists on burial of remains, even cremated ones, and partly because she didn't like having it around the house. Pop sat in a closet for a year or two, until one day, with no word to my brother or me, she brought him down to the Rand funeral home, pushed aside her guilt, and had the urn buried in a cemetery plot beside the one she'd reserved for herself. Initially, I'd sided with my father and was indignant over her disrespect of his stated request. When I realized how distressing his last wishes had been for her, I changed my mind. If I donated my body to science, my husband, Ed, would have to picture me on a lab table, and worse, picture all the things that might be done to me there. Many people would be fine with this. But Ed is squeamish about bodies, living or dead. This is a man who refuses to wear contacts because he'd have to touch his eyes. I have to limit my visits to the surgery channel for evenings when he's out of town. When I told him I was thinking about joining the Harvard Brain Bank a couple years back, he started shaking his head. Ixnay on the Ain Bank Bray. Whatever Ed wants to do with me is what will be done with me, the exception being organ donation. If I wind up brain dead with usable parts, someone's going to use them. Squeamishness be damned. If Ed goes first, only then do I fill out the willed body form. And if I do, I will include a biographical note in my file for the students who dissect me. You can do this. So they can look down at my dilapidated hull and say, "Hey, check this. I got that woman who wrote a book about cadavers." And if there's any way I can arrange it, I'll make the thing wink. This concludes Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers by Mary Roach. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for our growing library of inspiring, unabridged audiobooks by renowned authors. We also welcome you to sample all our titles, listen to author biographies, and take advantage of special offers at www.tantor.com or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog. I saw this happen between my father and mother. My father, who rejected organized religion early in his life, asked my mother to have him cremated in a plain pine box and to hold no memorial service. My mother, against her Catholic inclinations, honored his wishes. She later regretted it. People she barely knew confronted her about their disappointment over there having been no memorial service. My father had been a beloved character around town. My mother felt shamed and slandered. The urn was a further source of discomfort, partly because the Catholic Church insists on burial of remains, even cremated ones, and partly because she didn't like having it around the house. Pop sat in a closet for a year or two, until one day, with no word to my brother or me, she brought him down to the Rand Funeral Home, pushed aside her guilt, and had the urn buried in a cemetery plot beside the one she'd reserved for herself. Initially, I'd sided with my father and was indignant over her disrespect of his stated request. When I realized how distressing his last wishes had been for her, I changed my mind. If I donated my body to science, my husband, Ed, would have to picture me on a lab table, and worse, picture all the things that might be done to me there. Many people would be fine with this. But Ed is squeamish about bodies, living or dead. This is a man who refuses to wear contacts because he'd have to touch his eyes. I have to limit my visits to the surgery channel for evenings when he's out of town. When I told him I was thinking about joining the Harvard Brain Bank a couple years back, he started shaking his head. Ixnay on the Ain Bank Bray. Whatever Ed wants to do with me is what will be done with me, the exception being organ donation. If I wind up brain dead with usable parts, someone's going to use them. Squeamishness be damned. If Ed goes first, only then do I fill out the willed body form. And if I do, I will include a biographical note in my file for the students who dissect me. You can do this. So they can look down at my dilapidated hull and say, "Hey, check this. I got that woman who wrote a book about cadavers." And if there's any way I can arrange it, I'll make the thing wink. This concludes Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers by Mary Roach. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for our growing library of inspiring, unabridged audiobooks by renowned authors. We also welcome you to sample all our titles, listen to author biographies, and take advantage of special offers at www.tantor.com or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.